Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Paul Willis, Executive Director of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, along with Director of Communications and Events, Tracy Farrington Cunningham. We'll also hear from Marlene Tressman, whose new book is Fair Labor Lawyer, The Remarkable Life of New Deal Attorney and Supreme Court Advocate Bessie Margolin. Also, poet Ricky Laurentis, author of Boy with Thorn. It's such a pleasure to welcome my next two guests to The Reading Life. We're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, which is coming up March 30th through April 3rd. Executive Director Paul Willis started working with the festival in 2004, and Tracy Farrington Cunningham recently became the Director of Communications and Events. Tracy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
And Paul, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
It's so funny. It seems like just yesterday we were talking about the 25th anniversary, and here we are. So what are some of the things we should look forward to this year, Paul?
In terms of our theater events this year, we really have a great variety in terms of plays that you would know from Williams canon, including like Orpheus Descending, The Glass Menagerie. And then we also have quite a few opportunities to see works that you normally wouldn't have the chance to see. This year, we're working with the newly formed Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans, and they've packaged together an evening that's a full production of three Tennessee Williams one-act plays, which two of them have never been produced before. So it'll be the world premiere here at our festival. The University of Illinois is also going to be doing a staged reading of a short play called Goat Song that has never been published. It was found in the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas. And it's a play set in Cajun country, and some of the themes and storyline later developed in what became Orpheus Descending. So it's really nice to have that tie with Southern Rep doing the full production, which is actually going to be here at UNO at the Robert E. Nims Theater.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, Tracy, you work on a lot of the really special events, and some of them this year, I have to say, are really special. So.
We're really excited this year about our opening gala, although with the recent death of Harper Lee, it did take on a sort of poignant tone. It's called Badham, Bragg, and Tennessee. And we're bringing Mary Badham, who played Scout in the movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird. And she has a connection to Tennessee Williams because she was also in This Property is Condemned before she gave up acting as a teenager. And so with Go Set a Watchman coming out last year, Mary Badham sort of went on the circuit. And she's been doing a lot of lectures and speaking engagements. So we're excited to have her in conversation with Rick Bragg, who is a festival favorite. Everybody loves Rick Bragg. And he's a native Alabamian as well. And so we'll be at Le Petit Theater. We have food by Tableau beforehand. We have libations from Donner Peltier. We have the performance of these two wonderful writers and actors talking about Harper Lee, talking about Tennessee Williams, To Kill a Mockingbird, Go Set a Watchman.
And what are some of the other special events you've been working on?
We're really excited about our tribute reading this year. It's focusing on Tennessee Williams, the poet. And that is just a stellar cast of characters to read from his short stories, his letters, all of his writings. We have Dick Cavett. We have Pulitzer Prize winner Beth Henley, Lisa D'Amour, who's a native New Orleanian who's getting a lot of buzz, Dorothy Allison, who's a festival favorite, Jewel Gomez, Austin Pendleton, and really excited, Estelle Parsons is going to be there as part of that event. And we're thrilled to be partnering with the Jackson on the River, which is a beautiful new venue in Jack's Brewery. And attendees of the tribute reading will have cocktails and hors d'oeuvres overlooking the Mississippi River prior to this wonderful reading of Tennessee Williams' words.
And the tribute reading to me is always one of the most special events at the festival. I mean, you really hear his words in the ways in which they mean things to writers now. It's so lovely to see them interpret his poetry, and his poetry is so interesting and so good.
It's beautiful. And it's nice to see him and this whole scope of his work, not just a performance of his play, but a bunch of different pieces brought together under one theme. It's why I also like the tribute reading. It's a neat event.
It really is. So what are some of the literary highlights we can look forward to? Because there are some great writers coming this year.
I'm looking forward to our roster of master classes this year, I think is particularly top notch, including Rick Bragg, Dorothy Allison, Megan Abbott, who I really enjoy. And of course, one not to be missed is Susan Larson interacting with John Lahr on Friday afternoon at the Historic New Orleans Collection. Some of the individuals participating in panels that I'm looking forward to, Tracy had mentioned, but Beth Henley and Lisa Damore will be together on a panel celebrating 100 years of the Pulitzer Prize. And John Pope is going to be moderating that panel. And a panel I'm particularly looking forward to, being a huge LSU fan, is sports related, which will have LSU legend Billy Cannon participating on that panel.
So. Something for everyone, truly. Now, another festival gets folded into that weekend, and that's the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival. Paul, you started that festival. So tell us a little bit about where it is right now.
It's hard to believe that it's already going to be the 13th annual Saints and Sinners Literary Festival. It was started back in 2003. And I remember it kind of came to be working with my partner, Greg Heron, and Gene Redman, who works at the Noids Task Force and a great mystery writer. And we kind of came up with the name and idea. And 13 years later, here it is. And this will be the second year that it's become a part of the umbrella Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. It's a three-day event. We kick off with a welcome reception at the historic Gallier House during the Saturday and Sunday, April 2nd and 3rd, there's a roster of panel discussions. We have a reading series, which has five or six authors in each slot reading 10 minutes from their latest work, which it really is entertaining to see like all the genres and ideas and new works that are coming out in the LGBT community. And then on the Saturday night of the event, we have a book launch party that's a celebration of the short fiction contest that we do each year. And so our winner, two finalists, and a couple of other entries for the book will read from their work. And we cap the weekend off with a closing reception, a Hall of Fame induction, and you're helping this year as we select an Emerging Writer Award that Rob Burns has put together for the festival.
So do you think really this year's festival is the best ever? I mean, do you feel that way every year?
You do feel that way every year because you're investing, you know, I don't think people realize how much it takes to pull something like this together, that we truly are working on it all year. So you're really invested in what you're doing and the different collaborations that come together. But yeah, every year you feel like you've put your heart and soul into it and this is your favorite and you meet new and interesting people. Like, it's been fun to have correspondence with Estelle Parsons, who's going to be coming. Like I said, I'm excited to meet Billy Cannon. And with Saints and Sinners this year, it's awesome to have Dorothy Allison back and Jewel Gomez, Andrew Halloran, Felice Picano. So, yeah, it's a great feeling.
We've been talking with Paul Willis, who's the executive director of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, celebrating its 30th anniversary, March 30th through April 3rd, and Tracy Farrington Cunningham, director of communications and events. For more information about tickets and the complete schedule, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. For more information about Saints and Sinners, check out SASFest.org. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you, Susan.
New Orleans native Marlene Tressman is a former special assistant to the Maryland Attorney General and former law instructor at Loyola University of Maryland Selinger School of Business and Management. Today, we're talking about her very first book, a fascinating biography, Fair Labor Lawyer, The Remarkable Life of New Deal Attorney and Supreme Court Advocate Bessie Markelin. Marlene Tressman, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
Now, Bessie Margolin really comes to life in this terrific book, and she has a very unusual background, and you share some of that with her.
Absolutely. She was raised in the Jewish orphanage that used to be right at the corner of Jefferson and St. Charles, where the JCC now stands. And when the orphanage closed in 1946, I was orphaned about two decades later, but my care was given to the agency, the Jewish Children's Regional Service, that was the successor to the orphanage in which she was raised. And we also share our education at Newman School, which was founded in 1903 to educate the Jewish orphans who lived in the home.
Now, Bessie went to law school at Tulane in 1927, and that might surprise some folks. That just seems early on to be a woman law student.
Absolutely. Although Tulane had admitted women for several years before that, she was still the only woman in her class at her time. I think what's even more interesting to me is that she was the first woman that I can find who went to law school who was raised in the orphanage.
Amazing. And one of her first jobs after her legal education was working at the Inter-American Commission on Women in the 1930s in Washington, D.C.
That's absolutely right. And at first I thought, well, this is clearly where Bessie sank her teeth into what later would become her quest to ensure that women received equal pay under the law. But I was completely surprised when I learned she absolutely hated the job. Turns out she was bored to tears because most of her work was simply cataloging laws of Latin American countries that discriminated against women in the law. And the person who ran the organization, the quite famous Doris Stevens, who had been an early suffragist, was running the operation on a shoestring. Instead, Bessie was immediately drawn by the excitement of the New Deal and was eager to leave the Inter-American Commission on Women behind.
Yes, I love the way you describe her as a reluctant feminist.
That's the way she described herself.
But then she went on to become one of the founders of NOW originally.
And that was pretty interesting. I've never been able to find precisely how she showed up that morning in October of 1966. But what was so nice is when I listened to the actual audio recordings of that first meeting with Betty Friedan at the helm, Bessie was given a round of applause when she entered the room, likely because of her status as a very senior federal government lawyer who had already been championing the cause of women and equal pay.
Now, a lot of her work was concerned with the New Deal, and she worked on the Tennessee Valley Authority, and that consumed some 6 years of her life.
That's correct. And that was really where she cut her teeth and got her exposure to what would become her claim to fame, and that was Supreme Court litigation. She was the rare woman in the room, very little recorded about that you would find elsewhere, with some of the men who were considered the legal brain trust of the New Deal. And she was credited by them as giving the briefs their character and for materially shaping the legal arguments that were presented that, in fact, championed the New Deal's Tennessee Valley Authority, the first New Deal agency that was legitimized by the Supreme Court.
And she also distinguished herself by working on the Nuremberg trials.
That's right. And what was fascinating to me was that she pursued that work. She simply didn't wait to be invited. When it was first announced that Justice Robert Jackson would be stepping down from the Supreme Court to lead the first Nuremberg prosecutions, she sought to join him, and he politely told her that he had to put together a small team. Most of the people had already been selected. So as Jackson was finishing the first trials at Nuremberg, where some of the top Nazis were prosecuted, she again pursued this when the later prosecutions were occurring that are known as the subsequent proceedings. So she was tapped in May of 1946 to join the already in progress prosecutions, but her task was somewhat different. She was going to help draft the rules for the American-led prosecutions, separate from what Jackson had been doing, which was an international tribunal. And so she sat in and listened as the prosecutions of the first cases were happening. She was even there in the Nuremberg courtroom as Justice Jackson gave his closing arguments, but it was her job to draft the rules by which the remainder of the trials would occur. In fact, some of the ones I think people are most familiar with, such as the ones that formed the basis of the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, the trials that pertain to the jurists, the industrialists, and in fact the medical experiments that occurred at Nuremberg.
The fascinating thing to me is that she did all this really serious work while enjoying life so much. She never married. She never had children. She was drop-dead gorgeous. She enjoyed the lifestyle she created. She had this really bon vivant side as well.
Absolutely. And it took a lot for me to decide that it was just as important to tell her personal life story as her professional life story. I certainly only wanted to do justice to her career by writing this book.
And in your next book, you're going to be exploring another aspect of your shared past with Bessie, aren't you?
That's absolutely right. In fact, I guess it was the frustration that came from having loved learning so much about the orphanage in which she was raised and learning that I couldn't put it all in her first chapter about her childhood. So I decided then and there that I would dedicate myself to writing a book about the history of the New Orleans orphanage. And I'm very excited about doing it. I've even searched out, and people have been generously responding, people who themselves grew up in the home, it was later known as the Jewish Children's Home, or whose ancestors or grandparents grew up in the orphanage. So my goal is to write a collective biography. The orphanage spanned from 1855 to 1946 when it was closed. So it captures some of the most amazing historic moments in New Orleans and America's history.
Well, we'll all look forward to that one, too. We've been talking with Marlene Trussman, who's the author of Fair Labor Lawyer, The Remarkable Life of New Deal Attorney and Supreme Court Advocate Bessie Margolin. You can meet her Wednesday, March 9th at 6 at Octavia Books, or Thursday, March 10th at noon at the Tulane Bookstore. Marlene, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
Ricky Laurentis was born and raised in New Orleans. Currently, he teaches a course at Columbia University and at the Saturday course at Cooper Union, as well as running an after-school writing and literacy program at the Harlem Children's Zone. He's the winner of the prestigious 2014 Cave Canem Poetry Prize for his first collection, Boy with Thorn, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Ricky Laurentis, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here talking with you.
So tell us a little bit about your family. One of the things I love is that your book is dedicated to your grandfather, and thanks for reading to you, and that's a great gift to give anyone.
Yes, my grandfather definitely was a central figure in my life. He's no longer with us, but he was the person who would read to me, you know, in the afternoons and the evenings, and you know, he would put on the voices and put on the characters and really make, at that time, comics and then books later, a real sort of dramatic event. And that's what made literature and writing so interesting to me, really. And it actually made me envious. I remember being young and saying to myself that, you know, I want to write stories like that. I want to do those sort of things that he is sort of doing with his own sort of characters and things. So I dedicate the book to him because I think he's so important to me becoming the writer that I am today.
And then beyond that, you know, you attended your first Cave Canem retreat in 2008. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what that meant to you.
Yeah, it was incredible. I was still an undergraduate at Sarah Lawrence. It was the summer between my sophomore and junior year, which is a little bit unusual for most Cave Canem fellows. They're usually a little bit older. But I didn't feel in any way sort of ostracized or different. I was sort of immediately welcomed into that fellowship of Black poets, and it really gave me sort of mirrors and to look around and say, like, this thing that I'm pursuing is possible, and I can actually, it's sort of not a dream, it's a real idea that I can actually have manifest. So it was really important for me at that part of my, I guess, education.
I think it's so important when you're a young writer to see people doing what you want to do. Really, it makes all the difference in the world. Now, you've said that an important part of being a writer for you, and you're a relatively young writer, say 27, is that right?
Yeah, I just turned 27.
But you've said that an important part of being a writer for you is learning to recognize and trust your obsessions, which I thought was so interesting.
I definitely still think about that. And I actually got to that way of thinking via friends who are visual artists or via painters or other visual artists that I admire. You know, if you think about someone like a Rothko or, you know, any contemporary painting, there are obsessions that you see happening on the canvas, and you'll see that sort of move from painting to painting. And there was something about studying that and seeing that sort of unfold over the arc of a painter's or drawer's or whoever's career that told me that I could sort of trust in my own obsessions and trust these ideas or these thoughts that I have. And I may not know them at the time, but these sort of inklings in my brain are worthy of sort of being studied, and that I don't need to be overwhelmed with the idea that I'm being, let's say, redundant or being too restrictive or limited in my thinking.
Well, and obviously the arrangement of the words on the page is very important to you. This is such a beautiful book. You know, the object itself is quite lovely. Mm-hmm. These are very much poems of the body, and many of them are poems about pain. And the title poem, Boy with Thorn, is about that kind of sharp pain that endures, but that we have to carry with us no matter what. It's a fascinating look at life through your eyes, because you're so young.
I think a lot of it, to be honest, this sort of idea of that pain that you have to sort of show up and carry with you, I think I had to learn that sort of quickly through Katrina and through the experience being from New Orleans. And, you know, there's a certain pain that comes with seeing your city be revised in front of you, whether you wanted to or not. But you have to keep going. You know, the idea of being a survivor is that you don't dwell in it. You have to sort of walk with that pain and process it. So immediately after storm, and we were there during that time, and I write about that a little bit in the book.
Yes.
We went to California and we came back, and I graduated and went to college, but I still had to process all these things. And it was, in fact, the distance away from being from the city that allowed me, I think, that clarity to process it. But it did not necessarily delete the trauma or the pain. So when I think about that time, I think about that as a moment where I had to come face to face with that sort of knowledge. And of course, now as you have this knowledge, there's a kind of burden, but it's also, I think, useful knowledge to have in your mind to know that as much as we love pleasure, there is still something that we learn from pain as well.
Right.
So it's something I try to explore in the book.
Well, I wonder if you'd read one poem that I like very much called You Are Not Christ.
I would love to. This is You Are Not Christ. For the drowning, yes, there is always panic or peace. Your body behaving finally by instinct alone, crossing out wonder, crossing out a need to know. You only feel you need to live, that you deserve it, even here. Even as your chest fills with a strange new air, you will not ask what this means. Like prey caught in the wolf's teeth, but you are not the lamb. You are what's in the lamb that keeps it kicking. Let it.
I love that poem so.
Oh.
Now, you're coming to be this special guest at Lit Fest, which is this wonderful event for young writers in New Orleans, and you're not that far out of being a young writer from New Orleans yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of advice are you going to give these student writers?
Just so many things I am excited to say and want to say. You know, when I was writing, I'm sure that there were communities for young writers when I was sort of in high school, but they weren't available to me. I just didn't know about them. So I'm so excited for things like Lit Fest that there can be a community now, a very visible community for writers. I would tell them, it sounds sort of cliche, but to keep writing, but to also realize that, you know, everything that we write, some of them are the equivalent of like playing scales, right? And sort of like you're practicing your chops and you're trying to figure out a certain answer to a particular question. And some of them will be the things that end up in your book. So just giving yourself that permission to just experiment and try, and not saying that every poem or every short story or every essay needs to be the essay or the poem, but really giving yourself that space to say, I'm just trying to figure this out, trying to learn my chops, so to speak, and so I can push myself as a writer and as a person ultimately.
Well, you've obviously pushed yourself far along the way. I'm so glad to meet you. We've been talking with Ricky Laurentis, whose first book is Boy with Thorn. You can meet him March 12th at Lusher Charter High School when he appears at Lit Fest, which takes place from 9 to 3. For more information, check out nocca.com/litfest. That's noca.com/litfest. Ricky, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Manning Wolf and Bill Rogers discuss and sign dollar signs, Texas lawyer versus Boots King. And history retweets itself, Texas edition. Tuesday, March 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Marlene Tressman, discusses and signs Fair Labor Lawyer, the remarkable life of New Deal attorney and Supreme Court advocate Bessie Margolin. Wednesday, March 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. And again, Thursday, March 10th at noon at the Tulane University Bookstore. Sam Irvin discusses and signs It Happens in Louisiana, Peculiar Tales, Traditions, and Recipes from the Bayou. Wednesday, March 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The UNO Creative Writing Workshop hosts a reading by poets Laura Mullen, author of Complicated Grief, and Afton Wilkie, author of Clarity Speaks of a Crystal Sea. Wednesday, March 9th at 8 at the UNO Lakeside Campus Liberal Arts Building, Room 197. Travis Ian Smith reads from and signs his novel, Indie Darling. Thursday, March 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Toni McGee Causey signs her novel, The Saints of Lost and Found. Thursday, March 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. New Orleans Lusher Charter High School and New Orleans Center for Creative Arts present the 8th annual event for high school students, New Orleans New Writers Literary Festival. Saturday, March 12th from 9 to 3 at Lusher Charter High School, 5624 Ferret Street. Headlining is today's guest, poet and New Orleans native Ricky Laurentis, who will offer a masterclass and meet with a small group of students in a workshop setting. Other workshop sessions include screenwriting with Henry Griffin, fiction with Anya Groner, poetry with Laura Mullen, story games with Misha Krylov, movement and text with Nicole Buckles, and documentary writing with Phil Bertelson. In addition, there will be an open mic. For more information, email Laura Naughton at lnaughton, that's N-A-U-G-H-T-O-N, at noka.com, or go to noka.com/litfest. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Elysium by Jennifer Marie Brissett, Saturday, March 12th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. C.W. Lemoyne signs Executive Reaction, as well as the other books in his Spectre series, Saturday, March 12th at noon at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. SIFT, that stands for Sequence, Image, Form, Text, is holding its first fundraising gala, In Like Lions, Saturday, March 12th from 6 to 10 at the Southern Letterpress, Studio Apicki, 3700 St. Claude Avenue. There will be a silent auction and raffle, hands-on book activities, and funds go to supporting book artists and the programming that SIFT offers to the public. Lectures, artist appearances, and the Close Quarters series, which takes folks into different studios every month. For more information, check out the Facebook page, In Like Lions. Co-editor Mary Farmer Kaiser and contributing writers Shannon Freistack, Tanya Tetlow, and Leslie Gale Parr discuss and sign Louisiana Women, Their Lives and Times, Volume 2, Tuesday, March 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. Roy Blunt Jr. reads from and signs Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations, Tuesday, March 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. The East Bank Regional Library Great Books Club discusses Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, Tuesday, March 15th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.